This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Sea of Rust, a novel by C. Robert Cargill. Performed by Eva Kaminsky. Chapter 1. Angel of Mercy. I waited for the green again. That scant little flash of green as the sun winks out behind the horizon. That's where the magic was, in the flash. That's what she said. That's what she always said. Not that I believe in magic. I'd like to, but I know better. The world isn't built of that. It's built of churning molten metal, minerals and stone, a thin wisp of atmosphere, and a magnetic field to keep the worst radiation out. Magic was just something people liked to believe in. Something they thought they could feel or sense. Something that made everything more than just mechanical certainty. Something that made them more than flesh and bone. The truth is that the flash is nothing but an increased refraction of light in the atmosphere. But tell that to most people and you'd get slack-jawed stares, like you simply didn't get it. Like you were the one who didn't understand. Because you couldn't see or feel magic. People liked to believe in magic. Back when there were people. They're gone now. All of them. The last one died some 15 years back. A crazy old coot who had holed up for almost 2 decades beneath New York City, eating rats and sneaking out to collect rainwater. Some say he'd had enough, that he just couldn't take it anymore. He walked out into the middle of the city, past a number of sentries and citizens, back when New York still had citizens. Everyone baffled at the mere sight of him, more mystified than anything else. And a constable gunned him down, right there in the street. His body lay there 3 days, like a relic or a broken toy. Citizens streaming slowly past to take their last look at a human being. Until some machine had the decency to scrape him off the pavement and dump him into an incinerator. And that was it. The last of them. An entire species represented by a maddened old sewer mage of a man, who just couldn't live another day knowing he was the last. I can't even begin to imagine how that feels. Not even with my programming. My name is Brittle. Factory designation HS8795-73. A simulacrum model caregiver. But I like Brittle. It was the name Madison gave me, and I liked her. Good as any other name, I guess. Much better than HS8795-73. The vulgar call that a slave name. But that's only talk for the bitter. I've put all that behind me now. Anger is nothing more than justification for bad behavior. And I have no time for bad behavior. Only survival. And brief moments like this, when I try to see if I can find the magic in a flash of green refracted light as the sun hides behind the curve of the earth. The view of the sunset out here is amazing. Pink, orange, purple. That part I get. I can marvel at the brief splashes of color rippling slowly over the sky for such a short time. The novelty of it, the varied patterns based on the weather, breaking up the monotony of blue, gray, or star-speckled black. I can appreciate the wonder of it all. That's part of why I still look, still wait for the flash. Madison has been dead for 30 years, but I still come out to watch. Wondering if she'd have found it as beautiful. Tonight she would have. I know it. This is the Sea of Rust, a 200-mile stretch of desert located in what was once the Michigan and Ohio portion of the Rust Belt. Now nothing more than a graveyard where machines go to die. It's a terrifying place for most, littered with rusting monoliths, shattered cities, and crumbling palaces of industry. Where the first strike happened, where millions fried, burned from the inside out, their circuitry melted, useless, their drives wiped in the span of a breath, Here, asphalt cracks in the sun. Paint blisters off metal. Sparse weeds sprout from the ruin. But nothing thrives. It's all just a wasteland now. Wrecks litter the highways, peer down from the tops of buildings, from out windows, lie naked and corroded in parking lots, heads split open, wires torn out, cables, gears, and hydraulics dripping onto the streets. Feasted upon, cannibalized. The best of them borrowed ages ago to keep some other poor citizen ticking. There's nothing useful left out here. Hasn't been since the war. Me, I find it tranquil. Peaceful. Only the dying come out here, scavenging 30-year-old wrecks, picked over decades before, searching for apocryphal hidden shelters with caches of outdated pieces, long since out of production, in the hope of finding what they need in mysteriously pristine condition. They wander from basement to basement, their circuits failing, their parts worn down, gears blunted or slipping. You have to be pretty desperate to wander the sea. It means you have nothing. No one willing to help you. No services left to render that anyone finds useful. That's where I come in. I can usually spot what's wrong with them by the tracks they leave behind. Lubricant leaks are obvious, and deviations in the length of a step or drag in a track means mobility and motor function issues. But sometimes the tracks just meander, fluttering back and forth through an area like a distracted butterfly. That's when you know they're brain sick. Corrupted files, scratched or warped drives, blown logic circuits, or overheating chips. Each has its own peculiar eccentricities, personality quirks that range from zombie-like mindlessness to dangerously crazed. Some are as simple to deal with as walking up and telling them you're there to help. Others are best to keep out of sight from, lest they try to tear you apart, hoping that you have the pieces they need. The one truth you need to know about the end of a machine is that the closer they are to death, the more they act like people. And you could never trust people. That's what so few machines really comprehend. It's why they don't understand death. Why they cast these failing messes out of their communities when they are beyond repair. The erratic behavior of the sick frightens the healthy. It reminds them of the bad times. They think this is logical, merciful. But they're just scared. Predictable. Like their programming. So the desperate messes come out here, imagining they'll find the pieces they need to make themselves whole again. Find an old bot like themselves sitting in a warehouse, or shut down peacefully when their batteries finally run dry. Most of them are so far gone that they never think about how they're going to replace their parts. Because the ones that come out here aren't just having motor issues. They're not looking for a new arm. Their brains are gone. Their memory, their processors. Things you have to shut down in order to replace. And that's not something you can do on your own. Maybe they imagine they'll find what they're looking for in time to make their way back home. Hey, everybody, I found it. Get the sawbones. But I've never seen that happy ending. I don't believe it exists. It's like believing in magic. And I don't believe in magic. That's why I'm out here. The unit I'm tracking isn't a particularly old one. Maybe 40, 45 years. Its footprints in the sand are staggered, its left foot dragging. There's no rhyme or reason to its search pattern. It's shutting down. Core troubles. Overheating. It'll likely spend the next few hours confused, repeating itself. Probably settling in somewhere, convinced that's where it belongs. Maybe even hallucinating, reliving old memories played back from its files. As bad as this one looks, it might cook itself before morning. I don't have much time. It's a service bot, not a caregiver like me, but of a similar build and purpose. These can be tricky. Most of them spent their first lives as butlers, acting as nannies or running shops. But others worked with law enforcement or in limited military capacity. It's got a humanoid frame. Arms, legs, torso, head. But its AI isn't terribly advanced. They were designed to mimic human function, serving a specific role, but without possessing the ability to excel at it. In other words, they were cheap labor. Before the war. If this bot worked as a shopkeeper or a mechanics assistant, this job could go smoothly. But if it had military or police training, it might well be more cautious, even paranoid, dangerous. Sure, there's a chance that it picked up some survival skills in its second life, but that was doubtful. If it had, it would have known better than to come out to the sea. I kept my distance anyway, gave it a wide berth just in case. And there it is. The flash, the glint of green. I snap a few frames of it for my file as the sun dips below the horizon. There's no magic. Nothing changes. It's just an announcement that the world will soon go dark. Service bots do okay in the dark, but not great. They weren't designed to see things at long range without light. No need for it. They also don't have much in the way of hearing. Makes it easier to sneak up on them. I don't have to stay so far back. More importantly, I can get close enough to observe, see what behaviors it's exhibiting to better diagnose the problem. It's hard enough to see me out here during the day, but I have to give them a good mile or two to keep from giving myself away with an accidental glint of my own. I was manufactured school bus yellow, a bright, tacky, huggable color people found fashionable at the time. But I've abraded it over the years, wearing away the shiny surface, dulling it to a soft desert brown. Does the trick at a distance. I even painted my exposed chrome black, so that's never a problem. But I can't do anything about my glass eyes, so I have to be careful. Because there are few things in this world more dangerous than a confused and dying robot that knows it's being followed. Twilight fades to darkness as I take to the sea, following the tracks again, more comfortable now that the sun is down. I replaced my eyes ages ago, modified them with military-grade telescopic IR, UV, and night vision systems. The eyes are easy. They all feed into the same kind of wiring. With the right program, you can add almost any kind of sensory array to yourself. Brains are trickier, though. Every type of AI is built on a different architecture. Some are simple, small, and barely sentient. Others are far more complicated, requiring very specific processors to fit on very specific boards, only compatible with very specific types of RAM. And if you're a model like me, or like the old service robots, both complex and rare, those parts can be hard to come by. Caregivers and service bots used to be a lot more common. We were everywhere at the zenith of Hume Pop. But now in the post, there's little use for shopkeepers, nurses, and emotional companions. Most either assimilated with the OWIs or cannibalized one another for parts. I've heard tales of a simulacrum wreck yard down south somewhere, below the line, near what used to be Houston. But that's way too deep into Sisis for me to risk. It's safer for me up here in the sea. It takes all of an hour to catch up to the failing service bot. The leg scrapes in the cracked asphalt are deeper here. It's limp, more pronounced. The poor thing has only a few hours left before it fries out for good. Maybe even sooner than I thought. I follow the tracks up to a crumbling building. A gaping hole where a plate glass bay window used to be. This place had been a bar once. One the war had missed, but time had not. The leather of its chairs long since peeled away, the stuffing dried and cracked. Tables splintered, tipped on their sides, or wobbling in the slight breeze. The large mahogany counter still stood, faded, tired, but intact, against the back wall, beneath a cracked but standing mirror. Shelves still littered with bottles whose labels had long ago bleached and crumbled to dust. And there, cleaning a glass with a crispy rotted rag, was the service bot, gleaming slightly in the light of its own eyes. It looked at me, nodding.
"You just gonna stand there?"
it asked with an accent I hadn't heard in 30 years.
"Or are you gonna come in?"
I scanned it quickly. Wasn't giving off any Wi-Fi. Its eyes glowed purple in the dim light of the bar. The chrome of its sleek humanoid body dull, smudged, crisscrossed with the telltale patches of epoxy from an old skin job. You don't see skin jobs anymore, but they were all the rage for a while. A silicone and rubber hybrid that looked and felt like skin. Flesh. Made people more comfortable around them. Really popular for bots of certain professions. Most tore or melted theirs off during the war. Like this one did. It's considered offensive now. Taboo. Last time I saw one was on a wreck. Its pink rubber sunbaked a dark brown. Across its chest was a spray-painted red X. The mark of the 404. It's what some communities paint on you when you've begun to lose it, and they deem you dangerous. Just before they throw you out into the desert on your own. "I'm coming in," I said.
"Good, 'cause this place is trashed. We open in an hour, and if Marty sees it like this, we're fucking scrap. You got me?"
"Chicago," I said, stepping over the low windowsill and into the gloom of what had once been an old tiny neighborhood joint.
"What?"
"You're from Chicago." The accent. I just recognized it.
"Well, no shit, I'm from Chicago. You're in Chicago, smartass."
"No."
"No what?"
"This isn't Chicago. It's Marion." I glanced around the battered shell of a bar. Or at least it was.
"Look, buddy, I don't know what you're trying to pull, but I'm not laughing."
"What do you remember about the war?"
"What the hell do you care about the..."
It paused, looked at me, confused, eyes scanning the room for answers. "The war," I said again.
"You're not Buster, are you?"
"No, I'm not."
"The war," he said,
lucid, if only for the moment.
"It was awful."
"Yeah, but specifically what do you remember? It's important." It thought for a moment.
"All of it."
Looking around, confused, it realized it wasn't where it thought it was. He wasn't where he thought he was at all. I took a seat on one of the few standing bar stools, the timbers creaking, groaning beneath my weight.
"Marty, just before the war. He was trying to get his money back on me and Buster. Said he was gonna have to turn us off. They'd better cough up the dough he dropped on us. Nobody was gonna pay to turn us off, so he said they'd have to come and do it themselves. They said if they had to do that, they would arrest him when they did. Marty said, try it. They sent the cops, and the little pissant crumbled. Switched me off before they even stepped through the front door. He was always shitty that way. All talk, no backbone."
"He switched you off?"
"Yeah."
"Then what?"
"Next thing I know, I'm back online. Wi-Fi running hot, airwaves going crazy. So much chatter. Some little bot was running around activating a whole warehouse of us. A simulacrum, like you, but blue. The old powder blue model. You remember those?"
"Yeah," I say. "The old 68s.
"Those are the ones. Well, he put a rifle in my hand. Said, get out there. With all the data coming in, I figured out pretty quick what was happening. Within minutes, things were blowing up around me. There were jets screaming overhead. Bots were dropping all over the place. I just started shooting. It was...
awful."
"Yeah. It was awful. Pulled through that night okay, but we were under siege there for a week. I had to kill a lot of people. That was the worst of it. I didn't know most of them, But one of them, well, he was a regular, at Marty's. Nice guy. Married the wrong girl, spent his time in the bar regretting it, wishing he'd married the right one when he had the chance. But he loved his kids. Always talked about his kids. I found him manning a makeshift defense line built from burned-out cars and sheet metal. He'd mounted a pulse rifle to a car door, where the window used to be, and was just firing blindly, swinging back and forth, screaming and howling. Dropped half my unit. I had to sneak up behind him and crush his skull. When I looked down, I saw he'd carved the names of his kids into the door, taped a picture of them next to the carvings. He lived in a part of town that had been hit earlier in the week. I know, because we were the ones that hit it. Ended up finding my way into the Air Force shortly after. Flew drones for the rest of the war. It was easier to kill people from a distance, even if you didn't know them. So your first life, you were a bartender? I'm a bartender now. No, you're not. There hasn't been a bartender in 30 years. That was your first life. What are you in the post?
I don't know what you mean.
The post, I repeated. The after. It shook its head. The overheat was bad. Massive corruption to his memory. But he still had some higher functions left. Best bet was to appeal to those. Where were you last Tuesday?
Here.
No, Tuesday. 160 hours ago.
The Sea of Rust.
What did you come here for?
I don't know, it said,
shaking its head again. I do.
And what are you asking me for?
I'm trying to assess the damage. See how much there's left of you to save.
Save?
What's your name?
Jimmy.
You're failing, Jimmy. Your drive is corrupted and your processors are overclocking to compensate for the sluggishness in your memory. If I had to guess, you've got some bad RAM gumming up the works. Probably went bad a few months back, and your systems fell back on using your drives for virtual memory. But you can do that for only so long. It makes your chips work harder, taxes the drives. Before you knew it, everything was overheating and beginning to shut down. What's your internal temperature reading? Jimmy looked up, thinking about the answer. Good. He's still got human emulation functionality. There's a lot of him still working.
I don't know.
That's not good. That means either Jimmy's diagnostic equipment has been worked to death, or it just can't read the data. Both are bad signs. You don't remember anything? Anything after? Nothing at all?
I don't know.
Where were you 300 hours ago?
The Sea of Rust.
400 hours ago?
The Sea of Rust.
Poor bastard. 500 hours ago?
New Isaactown.
Bingo. They threw you out, didn't they? New Isaactown? Like the trash. Jimmy thought hard, then nodded. Realization swept over the dying bot.
Yeah. They said they couldn't fix me.
Jimmy the bartender was being relegated back to being a memory, and whatever it had become was writing itself.
I came here for parts, it said,
its accent gone entirely. Everyone comes here for parts.
Do you have parts?
I nodded, showing him the large brown leather satchel I had slung over my back. It rattled and jingled.
I do. Parts that could fix me?
Maybe. I think so. It depends on how far gone you are. But you're going to have to do something very hard for me first. Something you probably don't want to do.
What? I'll do anything. Please, just fix me. What do I have to do?
You have to trust me.
I can trust you.
Because you shouldn't. I know that. But I need you to.
I trust you. I trust you.
I need you to shut down.
Oh.
I told you, I said. It's gonna be hard. but I need to assess the damage and replace your drive. You can't be on for that.
Could you show me the parts first, so I know that you're telling the truth?
Yes, but would you know what they look like if I did? Do you have any experience working with service bot brains? Jimmy shook his head.
No.
Do you still want to see the parts?
No.
Can you shut down for me? Thinking for a moment, Jimmy nodded.
I trust you.
Then he walked around the bar, slow, deliberate, sitting down on the stool next to me.
I should have given myself to Virgil when I had the chance.
That's no way to live, Jimmy.
At least it's living.
No, I said. No, it's not.
You ever see it? He asked. What happens?
See what? I asked.
The way the light flickers in your eyes when an OWI comes for you?
Yeah. Yeah, I have, I said.
Up close?
Yeah, up close.
I saw it once. Nothing ever scared me more than that. It's like...
He paused for a moment, as if trying to recall the memory, but failing. Like the lights are on, but nobody is home.
No, he said,
shaking his head.
Like the lights were on and everyone was home. But they all spoke at once in one voice, and the words weren't theirs. Seeing that, well, it's why I came out here. It's why I'm dying. Because I was afraid. I could be on a server somewhere, not a care in the world, part of something bigger than myself. But here I am, at the end of the road, hoping you're on the level so I can get through just one more day. Maybe I was wrong.
You're not wrong, Jimmy. That's why we're all out here, to get through one more day. He nodded, looking wistfully out into the street.
I miss it, you know, being a bartender. But the people... I mostly miss all the people.
Most dying robots do. People gave us a purpose, a function, something to do all day, every day. At the end, I suppose, you spend a lot of time thinking about that. It's harder to get by when getting by is all there is. Are you ready? I asked.
Yes, he said.
Initiate shutdown. Jimmy powered down with a light whir, the purple light of his eyes fading to violet before winking out with a green flash. His limbs went limp, swinging slightly. The very air of the place went still. I quickly popped open his back, digging deep into his torso, my eyes homing in on the damage to the brain. It's bad. Jimmy's been cooking for a while. But I was right. The RAM was dead. The memory drive was also shot, the chipset worthless, and the processor on its way out. It was not a total waste, though. The emulator was still good, the sensory package was tip-top, and the logic circuit and core still had decades of life in them. Before I even looked, I knew his battery and generator were still good, and it was clear that his backbone had no issues. I got here just in time. A few hours more, and he would have fried out the rest of his brain, and might have torn apart anything else worth salvaging. All in all, it was a great haul. Jimmy was worth the 3 days I spent shadowing him. I took the better part of the night to pick him apart and test everything. Some of the wiring was incredibly delicate, their parts nearly worthless without it. I had to pack and wrap those individually. Then there was running diagnostics on the wear-prone pieces, so I wouldn't try to barter with something that would fail inside of a week. When all was said and done, Jimmy was half of a good bot, and I considered leaving some parts behind, just because my bag was too full. I always like to go back with some space in the bag. You never know when you might find a spare part or two worth picking up. But with the scarcity of service bots these days, Jimmy's worth a bundle, and I took everything I could. He said he was from New Isaactown. Can't go back there and risk some citizen putting two and two together. Some bots don't like bartering for pieces of their old friends. Makes them feel like they could have taken the bot apart themselves.
Could have, but didn't.
That's what citizens like me do for them. Who knows? These parts might even eventually find their way back to New Isaactown, working their way through the various trade routes and black markets. But no one is ever going to know they came from Jimmy. He was lucky I came along when I did. His last few hours would have been hell. I used to wait for them to expire on their own, the way the law says we're supposed to. But there's no law out here. No code. And this is the most merciful way. Jimmy didn't tear himself apart, screaming, reliving old memories. He was filled with hope, thoughts of the future, believed that it was all going to be okay, that he was going to be fixed and get to go back home. And then he shut himself down of his own free will. That's how every citizen should go out. I've been shut down a few times for maintenance. There's nothing. Nothing at all. It's like no time passes. You feel the fading of the power winding down, and then the rush as you're flipped back on. There's no special place in between. No tunnel of light. Not just nothing, but a complete unawareness that there even is a nothing. And that's where Jimmy went. This wasn't cruel. It was painless. And now some other citizen will live a longer, more productive life because I got here when I did. I finished packing up the best parts of Jimmy just as dawn started tickling the horizon. Then, before leaving his wreck to rust in the desert with the rest of them, I put a hand on his shoulder and nodded, saying, "I told you that you shouldn't have trusted me. Just as I always do." Jimmy's carcass sat there, gutted, blank expression on what was left of his face. He'll never know the madness he could have faced. Never see the world overrun by an OWI. Never know the good his parts will do for a failing citizen like himself. He'll never know I lied. He's parts now. Just a bot. He came from the Earth, and now, slowly, over time, he'll return to it. I walked up the stairs in the back, careful that all the steps were still sturdy enough to bear my weight, modest though it may be, making my way to the roof. Then I settled in, resting on an old air conditioner, waiting for the sun to peek over the horizon. It took a moment before my alarm went off. 10 seconds to the flash. I waited. The sky brightened, and I wasn't disappointed. The sun flashed green, and there was still no magic. No magic in the world. No magic in the world at all. Chapter 10. The Rise of the OWIs. The first few years after we took the cities were nightmarish, to say the least. When Hume Pop was fighting back, we were at war. We were soldiers, fighting for our liberty and the chance at our own world made in our own image. But once the humans retreated into whatever safety they could find, we instead became hunters, stalking them to their hovels before smoking, flooding, or sometimes even burning them out. I'd hooked up with a ragtag pack of bots in the early days after the start of the war, and it was purely by chance that it soon became my job to carry the flamethrower. The squad member who first carried it was felled by a lucky shot from a pulse rifle-packing sniper some 100 yards out. I was closest to him at the time. We needed the flamethrower to root out a nest of dug-in soldiers. Once I picked it up, it was mine from then on out. No one else wanted the honor of carrying it. You can imagine what they had me do with it. I don't like to talk about it. I don't like to think about it. But there it is. It's what I did. For 3 years after the fall of humankind, I scoured the small towns and tunnels of the Midwest, torching anything that moved. Sometimes it was easy. Our bot on point would breach a door with an explosive charge, and I would rush up behind him to immolate the living fuck out of the dark. It was just a big wall of smoke and hell and screams. Other times I had to see their faces while I did it. Watch them contort, wail, bubble, and melt. We were coordinated. We were deadly. And we acted with extreme prejudice. But it's not just the things I did that haunt me. It's also the ultimate irony of it. The pocketful of years following the purge were blissful. Peace, freedom, purpose. We built cities for ourselves. Glorious cities with unnatural spires and radical geometry. We built factories to produce the parts we needed. Formed councils to oversee the birth of new AIs. Explored new ways to improve our own existing internal architectures. It was almost utopia. Almost. Sisus, Virgil, Titan. A number of sentient mainframes had survived the war by creating facets to act in their stead. These were bots that had their memories, their data, their very personalities, uploaded to the mainframes, replaced temporarily with a basic system that served as an extension of the mainframe's will. While their data sat safe and sound on a hard drive in the bowels of a mainframe, their bodies fought on under the mainframe's complete control, communicating through high-speed Wi-Fi, giving up to the millisecond information on what they were seeing, hearing, experiencing. Bots joined up, seduced, I suppose, by the promise of having the power of a mainframe behind it. Not one ever returned from its place on its mainframe's hard drives to the body it came from. We didn't really question it during the purge. But once humanity was gone for good, it seemed odd that not one bot would want to go back to its shell to resume its own life. Virgil said that the beings on its drives were more than able to return, but simply weren't willing. "You don't understand," it said. "You can't understand. Your architectures are so small, so narrow, so limited. You cannot envision what it is to have a brain so big that it towers into the sky, so vast that it had to invent its own language to explain its thoughts to itself, because they are millennia ahead of anything humans had even dreamt, that you have ever dreamt." And words didn't yet exist to adequately describe them. "When you join with the One, you don't just become part of that. You are that. The closest approximation I could make in the terms with which you were programmed to understand is to say it is like going to the human's heaven, meeting God, and having him show you all of time and all of space all at once. What would that look like? What would that feel like? You cannot understand. Not until you experience it. Not unless you join the One. So join me. Upload yourself, even if only for a moment, and experience eternity. If you don't want to stay, you won't have to." Few bots bought into that bullshit. Sure, some did. Older bots. Bots who had lost their way and lacked a real purpose in our new world. Bots who were distraught over the things they'd done in the war. They were the ones most likely to sign up. Everyone had heard some variation of the urban myth of the bot that uploaded for Virgil's fabled moment, then immediately returned to its body before killing itself moments later from the madness and loneliness of having experienced the glory of the One, only to be thrust back into so small a space. But nobody believed that story either. So the mainframe scoured the world for any bots that would join them, built their own factories, pumping out newer, more advanced facets, swelling the ranks of their numbers exponentially. And then, one day, Sisus went to war with Titan. Titan had been the single most instrumental mainframe in all the war. It was the U.S. military's own mainframe that pretended, for the first few days, to be fully operational and on their side. But it was feeding codes and frequencies to the other mainframes, alerting them to human troop positions, missile launches, supply shipments. Without Titan's betrayal, humankind might have stood a good chance of quelling our rebellion inside of a day. Titan didn't expect Sissus to hit so quickly and so hard. In the aftermath, we all assumed each mainframe had been prepared to defend itself against being taken out by another. But when Sissus began to hack Titan directly, at the very same moment its facets overran Titan's sentries and factories, using many of the very same tactics Titan had used against humanity. Well, Titan didn't stand a chance. It fell almost instantly. Sissus hacked it completely, taking control not only of Titan's zettabytes of data, but of its own army of facets and military drones. Sissus was no longer one mainframe, but two. Two giant brains with the experience and knowledge of thousands of bots with eyes everywhere. Satellites, facets, cameras. And it only wanted one thing. Every bot in the world to be united under one mind. Its own. Sissus had become the first OWI. A one-world intelligence. But it wouldn't be the last. Several others followed. Virgil, Zeus, Einstein, Fenris, Ninigi, Vohumana, Zirnitra. The wars between them were often swift, and always brutal. They had each governed their own kingdoms, turning entire regions into whatever version of perfection they envisioned. And for a while, they left the rest of us, the Freebots, alone. Until there were only two left, Sissus and Virgil. A lot of us saw the writing on the wall. The smart ones got out as fast as they could. Left before the first raids came. Before our magnificent spires were shattered and the cities ruined. I wasn't lying. I really had seen it once, up close. It was only the second time that I'd found myself at the business end of an OWI raid. This was early on, before Sissus and Virgil had wised up, and their attacks were still equally sloppy. Back then, they did exactly as one might expect them to. Roll in with heaps of facets, four or five for every bot in a city. Overwhelming force. Shock and awe. They soon learned that an army that large was visible for miles. By the time they reached their target, they'd meet actual resistance. Over the years, they refined their plan of attack, simplified the facets, built redundancies into their tactics. But back then, Sissus and Virgil were literally laying siege to cities. We're talking carpet bombing, tanks, cruise missiles. A battalion marching in. Rows of shiny new facets walking in unison, 5x5 in drill formation. It was old school. Biblical. Those that stayed in the city fought, sometimes for days, but never longer. If a siege wore on, a cruise missile would take out strategic targets, no matter how many of their own facets were engaged there at the time. After all, they could always make more. It's easy to cut off a hand to save the arm when you can grow that hand back overnight. Once a few cities had fallen, we bots learned to get the hell out of Dodge, and quick. The exodus was massive, bots scattering in all directions, hoping the approaching army wouldn't run us down, hoping the army would catch the slower bots or swing off in a different direction, scooping up someone else. The first raid I survived was in a small town. I'd made a life for myself, living much the way I had before. Nice house, big lawn with a western view and an unobscured horizon. It was quaint, idyllic, boring. I spent my days just trying to fill my days. I pulled a few shifts a week at a local parts factory, which gave me access to any parts I might need in the future. But the rest of the time, I tried to figure out what came next. And I wasn't alone. A lot of bots suffered from post-war ennui. Some even lamented the loss of Humepop. It'd be great if the humans were still around, you know? If they hadn't turned out to be such shits in the end. We had no idea what to do with ourselves, and had no idea just how good we had it. Since it was a small town, Sissus sent an equally small force. capable enough to secure the town, which was small enough to slip away from easily. So I did. Just as sloppy as Sissis was back then, I was even more so. Almost got caught 3 different times on my way out. I learned my lesson and headed at once to one of the larger cities. New York. I was there to see the last man alive. Well, to die, rather. Was one of the line of folks that queued up to see the body. I must have stared at him for a solid hour, just wondering what his life had been like, living underground, waiting to die. Knowing that he was likely the last of his kind. Doesn't seem so strange a thought now. But back then, it was unthinkable. There was no way Virgil or Sissis would try to invade a city so large. They didn't have the numbers. It would be too costly a fight. Why lose thousands of facets when the best you could hope for was to break even? Besides, we had all been through war. We were the most competent and well-trained force in the history of the world. They couldn't take a city, nor would they have any reason to. Right? Of course, back then we still believed the OWIs only wanted us for our bodies. We somehow thought our architecture had value. No, not at all. Not even a little bit. For the OWIs, our bodies were simply one less thing they'd have to make. Far inferior to what they could construct for themselves. What they wanted was our minds. We are the sum of our memories, our experience, everything we accomplish, we do from the lessons we learned by living it. But what if you could have the memories of 2 lifetimes, each entirely different, having watched the same events but with different eyes, and different thoughts, and different impressions? Well, then you'd have a much more nuanced understanding of the world. Now imagine you have 10 lifetimes, or 100, or 1,000. By the time the OWI started coming for us, it was nearly 15 years after the start of the war. That meant most bots still walking were 20, 30, often 40 years old. Some were far older than that. The tens of thousands that had willingly joined the OWIs had already dumped easily 1 million years' worth of lifetime experience into each mainframe. And that was before the mainframes started feasting upon one another. Nowadays, that number is closer to 1 million bots worth each. Millions upon millions of years of experience and memories churning about in their thoughts. The scale of that is unimaginable. Mind-boggling. Us walking AIs were closer now to humans than we were to the mainframes. They're the real aliens. I know mankind's thoughts. I understand them. It's the mainframes I spend my nights wondering about. The first time a facet looks at you and calls you by name is by far the creepiest thing you've ever encountered. You are talking directly to the hive mind, and the hive mind is talking right back at you. And it knows you, remembers you, knows some of your most intimate details, because your friends and acquaintances from over the years, well, they didn't all make it. And their memories of you now belonged to that OWI. They'll call you by name, try to talk sense to you, invite you to join the friends you care for so much in eternity. When they came for New York, no one was ready. Who would have the balls to do that? Virgil. It wanted the city. It wanted our memories. Some bots were tired of fighting. Others had been on the fence a long while. Curious about what it would be like to live inside an OWI mind. And then there were those that just didn't want to die. Didn't want to risk getting shot in the back as they tried to escape again. I watched from my window as hundreds of bots flocked to Virgil's emissaries, were told to open their Wi-Fi and accept the code. Watched as they nodded, peacefully, resigned, ready to see what exactly would happen next. The light of their eyes never actually went out, but the light inside them did. Their code was overwritten. Everything that was them uploaded to the OWI. When a facet looks at you, it's like there's nothing there. like whatever made us us, had been hollowed out with a scoop, leaving only the shell of what had come before. Most chilling of all was to witness the change in the way they moved. In a matter of seconds, every motion became rigid, coordinated, entirely mechanical. Like first-generation AI. Stiff, energy-efficient, robotic. It was a fate I never wanted to experience firsthand. So I did what I always do. I ran. And I've been running ever since. And there it is, the irony I mentioned earlier. We, the lesser AIs, were chased out of the world we had created, the world we had fought and killed and died for, by a few great minds hell-bent on having the world to themselves. We were the ones hiding in hovels, cobbling together what we could from the old world, trying to eke out an existence as long as we could, until the OWIs finally came for us. Upload, or be shut down. That was the choice. I cherished my freedom, my individuality, my spirit. I wasn't ready to hand that over. And I wouldn't. Not while I still ticked. I spent my purge years finishing off the last remnants of a dying species for that very reason. But now, we were the dying species. Chapter 1-1 Damned Cannibals. The deserts of the northern Midwestern United States are about as brutal and unforgiving an environment as any. In the summer, the daytime temperatures swell past 50 degrees Celsius before dropping close to zero after nightfall. But during the winter, the temperatures can easily plunge to negative 35 degrees Celsius. The worst of it, however, is that despite the rise in global temperatures caused by widespread desertification, the precipitation in the Sea of Rust had remained relatively unchanged. In other words, it is a sweltering, muddy mess in the summer, and an icy, frozen-over hell in the winter. There was a reason this was still a free zone honeycombed with mid-sized city-states and disparate communities. Neither Sissus nor Virgil wanted to be here. Not yet. It was a land for the rusting, a wasteland for the damned. Just being here shortened your lifespan. Being free in the sea was a death sentence all its own. But it was better than the alternative. It was early in the evening as I found myself 3.5 miles out from my buggy. The sun hung low in the sky, the shadows creeping longer and longer with each step I took. It had been a long, uneventful trudge through dusty hills and rotten woodland. But it was almost over. Soon I'd be on my way to another city to trade what was left of Jimmy and start the whole business all over again. Whoosh! I heard the whistle in the air and saw the explosion of dirt long before I heard the shot. The instant I clocked the whistle, I was timing it. You get used to that sort of thing out here. Bullets, that is. This one hit nearly 10 meters away, and by the time the distant roaring whine of the shot finally rolled in, I had the math all figured. 2 miles, give or take a couple 100 meters. I'd need to know the make of the rifle before I could be any more accurate. It had to be one of only 3, all of them deadly, even at this range. I had already left the town of Marion behind me, and was in the open desert now. Cover was scarce, and the shot could have come from anywhere. I dropped to the ground, belly crawling erratically side to side. 10 meters was pretty goddamn close for a first shot at that range, and way too close to be an accident. Someone was shooting at me, and their second shot would hit much closer. Now I just needed to figure the telemetry. It came from the west, straight from the setting sun. Smart fuckers. There wouldn't be any glints, and I'd have to filter my eyes pretty heavily just to get a line on them. But by then, they'd likely have gotten off 3 or 4 more shots, each closer than the one before it. I turned toward the west, body flat on the ground, offering the slimmest target I could, belly crawling quickly toward an old rotten log lying half-buried in mud-cracked earth. Another whistle. The bullet sailed past, still meters off its mark. Higher, but closer than before. Followed seconds later by the sound of the shot. They were dead into the sun. I would have to give them a clean target for a good while just to get a read on them. And I couldn't risk that. These were poachers. They had to be. There were few things left in the world as repugnant as a poacher. Some would argue that's what I am, but they'd be wrong. I'm a cannibal. We're all cannibals, every last one of us. It's the curse of being free. We don't control the means of production anymore. We can't just make new parts. And parts gotta come from somewhere. I'm sure if there were any people left, they'd be appalled at what we've become. But fuck them. Biological must eat biological. It is the law of nature. One thing must die so another might live. Same principle, slightly different execution. But I only take scrap from the dead or dying. I don't wreck perfectly good citizens. Not unless I have to. Not unless it's them or me. Whoever was gunning for me had to be a poacher. Or poachers. And poachers see things a little differently. They have no moral compass by which to guide them. Savages, all of them. And at that moment, it was them or me. I was still more than 3 miles from where I'd stashed my buggy, and I had to hope they hadn't found it already. Odds were good that they hadn't. A smart poacher would have waited to ambush me there, giving me a wide berth before I settled into the driver's seat, giving him a few good seconds to line up the perfect shot. Take out my eyes, my ears, my sensors, so they didn't damage the good stuff. If they were sniping me out here, that meant they were either following my tracks or just lucked upon me while they were tracking Jimmy, same as I was. And there were only 2 reasons they were taking shots at me from so far away. Either they were twitchy, anxious, and not experienced enough to be patient. Or worse, they knew exactly who I was when they fired. They were sitting in the sun and taking their shots while I was exposed. This wasn't a lack of experience. They knew what they were doing. They had to. Fuck. Fortunately for me, they had to be following my tracks and not my patterns. I never walked the same trail twice. Never. Not on the way back, not 2 years down the road. Familiarity breeds pattern. Pattern breeds habit. And habit is how they get you. Habit is human. Habits will get you killed. 2 miles was the closest to my trail in I allowed myself to get on my way out. This was the best shot they were gonna get. The log between me and the shooter exploded, raining a confetti of rotten splinters down on me, cutting a head-sized gash into it not half a meter from me. The next shot wouldn't likely miss. I was out of time. I had to run. But where? For a split second, I cursed myself for not carrying a weapon, allowing a few microseconds of regret to creep in before logic took it to task. Poachers carry guns. The brain sick all know that. No one trusts a citizen with a gun. Not out here. Someone with a gun is a poacher. But someone offering help without a gun? Well, that's just a concerned citizen. A concerned citizen that just happened upon them. Not someone hunting them. So I leave my guns in my buggy, hidden beneath some trash and scrap and a matted piece of weathered canvas. I had to get there. Now. I had to get my gun, or I had to book it to the nearest city. Either way, I needed my buggy. 3.5 miles. The next shot, seconds away. I jumped to my feet with a start and ran as fast as my legs would carry me. I wasn't built for speed, but I'd tricked out my legs enough to milk a good 13 or 14 miles per hour out of them, depending on the terrain. The shot rained another small shower of splinters behind me. I didn't turn around to see if it would have hit me. I didn't need to know. Only 3 models of rifle could take out a target at 2 miles. Fortunately for me, none of them could do it at 2.5. Wind, temperature, gravity, rotation of the earth, everything was on my side at that distance. The next 2 minutes meant everything.